the history since the Land Grant Act of 1862, even, in fact, through the 40 years or so since Clark Kerr wrote those words. We should not be surprised. Universities are full of smart, highly motivated people. They have repeatedly addressed big challenges with new ideas, sometimes very clever ideas indeed, when they've grasped the issues well. In the quote that I offered, Clark Kerr's last few words are striking, and with governance carried on in much the same ways. For 500 years, he meant. Now, why would that be? Universities are famously peculiar places for their recursive, consultative ways of reaching decisions. Shared governance, we call it. It's the idea that the faculty have a formal place in decision-making shared with appointed officers such as the deans, chancellors, and presidents, and shared even with the trustees by their own delegation. Many newcomers and casual observers of higher education inaccurately perceive shared governance as a relatively modern development, probably based on the tendency of our age to make most things more democratic. That's not the root at all. It's a timeless arrangement, an indispensable arrangement. Let me identify three reasons why this is so. First is the cardinal goal of learning communities, which is to allow individuals, both students and teachers, to develop as far and as fully as they can. In the end, higher education is about establishing and exercising the individual's ability to learn, both independently and collaboratively. Students and scholars have different abilities and talents, different fascinations and insights. Individual development requires a certain amount of freedom and study and inquiry, access to facilities within reason, and flexibility in the student's ability to consult and work with faculty members. Some of this is about formal coursework, but not all. The informal aspects of the way the community works are often just as important. To operate so that freedom and flexibility are combined with rigor and with essential curricular standards, there must be very substantial local authority at the department level, at the program level, inside departments, and even at the level of individual faculty members. One has no choice but to rely on the judgment of the people on the ground. Second is the enormous diversity of educational and research lines in a modern university. Our institutions offer degrees in piano performance and Asian history, in electrical engineering and law, in finance and linguistics. Mastering and teaching any one of these subjects is very different from doing the same with any of the others. The institutions also teach at different levels. Working with freshmen is vastly different from working with professional students in law or medicine, which is different again from working with doctoral students. Even at the doctoral level, there can be big differences inside a single field. Developing a student in theoretical physics is quite distinct from developing one in low temperature experimental physics. There's no way for governing boards or even appointed officers at the level of dean and above to command the requirements and operational detail needed for this great range of scholarly and educational activity. Decisions about academic content, facilities, capacities, admissions of students, qualifications of faculty to be added, and many other matters must be delegated in an orderly manner to the people who know. Third is that the faculty of a university are far more than a workforce. They are the core asset on which productivity toward every mission rests. Degree programs for research facilities and major collections are essentially meaningless without a faculty with a genuine ability to bring life to them. Without commitment and distinction in the faculty, there would be fewer